every day in our courts we see that we are prosecuting the mentally ill, we're prosecuting our homeless neighbors, and that our jails are now 80% Black and brown. We need a prosecutor who has seen the other side of the system, who's seen the impact of the criminal justice system on families and communities, and who's willing to change that day to day and to have a vision for an LA county that is more just.
Los Angeles County District Attorney candidate Rachel Rossi, I'll speak with her in a few minutes from now. First, a sad and shocking firsthand account of California's homelessness crisis. It's an incredible scene, a sprawling slum next to a Home Depot parking lot, tarps and tents as far as the eye can see at the High Street Camp in Oakland. A United Nations official toured it recently and said it looked like shantytowns in Delhi, India. 100 or so people live there in shacks or trailers cobbled together from stuff found in dumpsters. There's no running water, no electricity, no toilets. Thomas Fuller spent 3 months documenting the conditions at this camp for the New York Times. He's their San Francisco bureau chief, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, describe what you saw and who you met.
It sounds a little harsh for those of us in California, but it really felt like a refugee camp to me. I mean, I met people who had fled paradise, you know, someone whose house burned down in paradise. I met someone who...
You mean where the fire was?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I met someone who had fled Lake County when their house burned down. I met a woman who had a Bay Area connection but had moved to Texas, and her home flooded in the hurricane there in 2017. So it was just remarkable. And of course, those are kind of the literal refugees. But then there are people whose lives were just interrupted by, you know, falling off a ladder, mm-hmm. or a terrible medical emergency with all of the, you know, crazy bills that we know we can suffer here if we have the bad luck of having it. So it all of this together just sort of, it was a picture. It was sort of a framework of how to understand how the roots of this problem.
And how many of them are suffering from some kind of mental illness or drug addiction?
You know, there was certainly alcohol there. There were certainly drugs. But I found most of the people in this encampment to be very lucid. I would say this is a different situation from, say, Market Street in San Francisco, or maybe even Skid Row in LA, where these people are organized. You know, they're organizing themselves, they're coming together as a community, they're building, some kind of structures or bringing in trailers. So it's a different demographic. And your question kind of goes to the heart of this question of categorization, mm-hmm. and I find it's so hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard to, again, you know, where everyone came from, but also just their personal outlook and their path. You know, every path is so different, and
yeah.
I think it's almost more frustrating to know that, because what does that mean for a solution if it's not, you know, I mean, I didn't really meet people who said, oh, yeah, well, housing prices, eviction, that's why I'm here. You know what I mean? It was all these different catastrophes that were very varied.
But that is how we talk about it these days, that it's the housing crisis that's causing the spike in homelessness, because how else do we understand it? It seems to have just appeared in a few short years, as rents have gone up and housing prices have gone up. And yet, as you say, there are so many different reasons for people falling into homelessness.
Well, it's so logical to say, you know, I mean, it's so logical, and of course it's true. I mean, the solution to homelessness is a house. I mean, that's a tautology. But on the other hand, I found it to be a lot more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
And losing someone's house was, you know, certainly a factor for the people at this encampment, but it wasn't the only thing by any stretch.
So how long have they lived there, and how permanent is this camp?
Well, some have lived for 5 years. I think the longest was 6 years, kind of the pioneer resident. This was a vacant lot. And, you know, you have people. I met a man named Gilberto who was in the construction business. He had a traffic accident. And that just sort of really disrupted his life. He couldn't work anymore. He ran out of savings. And he was one of the first people who just sort of settled in this vacant lot. He just needed a place to sleep. He built a shack there, and the community kind of built around him. There was another woman who came soon afterwards, and she became kind of the de facto leader of the camp. But yeah, so around, you had anything from 5 years, which is a long time to be in this very makeshift environment with, as you say, no running water, to a few months. Some people come for a few months and then they find a solution. What was really heart-wrenching is that you had people in this encampment who had babies with them there. I mean, there was one family that was 3 generations. I can't imagine raising a baby in a without any running water, without a shower, without a kitchen. It's incredible.
And you profile an 8-year-old girl who is a really incredible picture of her wearing her little pink backpack on her way to school, walking to school. She's been living there for 5 years.
Right. I mean, can you imagine that? Just sort of leaving, and this was on a very rainy day that picture was taken, and the shack, for lack of a better word, the shed that she lives in and has lived in for the last 5 years with her mother, was just surrounded by mud and filth, and she left that shed and then got, onto BART and then headed off to school. I mean, I just that perspective of showing up at school and, playing on the playground and sitting in the classroom, and then having the other part of your life being this very temporary, and I should say dangerous too. I mean, it's dangerous for women there. It's dangerous for anyone there who, especially at night. It's just what an incredible duality to go to to go to school during the day and then live there at night.
Yeah. So dangerous because from the other people who live there, or do people come in from outside to prey on the people there?
People definitely come in from the outside. You can imagine a community. First of all, it's very dark there at night, and it's a kind of a lawless place. So the residents do try to organize, but this is a pretty big camp. It attracts criminal elements, it attracts drug dealers, it attracts all sorts of people go there just to dump their garbage. And all the women I spoke to there said that they felt quite unsafe there at night and usually would just be indoors.
What do Oakland officials say about this, and what do they plan to do about it?
Well, believe it or not, this is one of 100 encampments in Oakland right now. Now, most of them aren't this big, but the city of Oakland, like a lot of California cities, are just in a bind. What do? People need a place to stay. They don't have proper housing to put them in, so they've created now an RV lot across the way from this encampment, and they're hoping people will stay there. But the land where this encampment is, the High Street encampment, is half of it's city land, and the other half is owned privately. And someone wants to build a fast food restaurant there. So they will have to disperse, and they say by the end of the year.
So you also traveled to Mexico City to look at a similar shanty town. How did that compare with what you saw in Oakland?
Well, that was really fascinating. I mean, it's obviously very hard to compare a much poorer country like Mexico with ours, but it was interesting because, in a sense, the shanty town that we visited there had more facilities and more flexibility. The city actually said, "Hey, you have nowhere to go. Why don't you just set yourselves up next to these railway tracks? And, you're here temporarily. Just understand that this is not your land. This will never be your land, but this is a place that at least you can stay for a while." They've been there more than 10 years. They've set up illegally electricity to their house, plumbing to their house. They have all these hoses that run into their homes. They've set up septic tanks. And, it's not the way we would do things in the US, but on the other hand, it gives the community a sense of semi-permanence, and it gives them, well, all the basic necessities. It gives them a way to carry those out. They have kitchens, they have showers, they have toilets. I mean, they don't have hot water, but so that was really fascinating that in some ways a society that is less developed has more opportunities for people to get along, to adapt, to especially people in crisis, and there were extended families there, so people were kind of taking care of each other.
Well, do you see that as the future of these encampments here, that they just become, you know, like permanent refugee camps?
I mean, it's just not the way we do things in America, so I can't imagine that's the future. But on the other hand, we have this rising number of homeless in almost all big cities in California, and we haven't found an answer. And you know, those numbers, like, for instance, 8,000 in San Francisco, that's not, you don't house 8,000 people and the problem is over. People are constantly coming into homelessness all the time. So it really is, people will, for the foreseeable future, be needing just a place to put their head down. And often that is now on side streets, back streets, in very old trailers, or in vacant lots like this. And I don't think there's, any end of it in sight.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much. Thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome. Thank you, ma'am.
Thomas Fuller from the New York Times. You can check out his expansive visual portrait of this sprawling homeless encampment in Oakland at the New York Times. The water off the California coast is acidifying twice as fast as the global average. That's according to a new study by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The higher the acidity, the harder it is for creatures in the ocean to build their shells. Kelp beds die, and it leaves some of the country's most valuable fisheries at risk. Here to talk to me more about this study is Rosanna Shaw. She covers the California coast for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Happy to be on.
All right. So that's a pretty shocking statistic. The ocean water off California's coast acidifying at twice the rate of other ocean waters. Why is that happening?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Ocean acidification is still a fairly new field of research. So scientists have only had data really going back to when they started monitoring all this. So with this new study that came out this week, the scientists were really able to quantify for the first time the rates of change in acidity in the ocean over a 100-year period off of the West Coast. And they found a lot of interesting things that confirmed what people were suspecting, but also identified kind of the interesting weather patterns off of the West Coast that cause El Niños and La Niñas and kind of all of the swings in weather that we are used to, also affecting kind of the rates of acidification in California.
So is it all weather related or is it also because of pollution?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I would say ultimately ocean acidification and our record amounts of carbon emissions in the atmosphere is tied together. The ocean is absorbing so much of our carbon, and the carbon itself is what makes the ocean acidify. Basically, when carbon dioxide mixes with seawater, it undergoes all these chemical reactions that increase the water's acidity, and all these chemical reactions is what's hurting the marine life. It's what's making shellfish having a more difficult time to build their shells. It's, think about it like the ocean getting more and more sour.
Mm. And so when things like mussels and clams and oysters can't form their shells, what does that mean for animals higher up on the food chain?
I mean, it's definitely hurting our shellfish industry. I think they're definitely feeling it already. The projections that are coming on acidification is not looking good for not just shellfish, but also, our coral reefs across the world and also fish itself. I think there have been really interesting studies even on sharks and how acidity, greater acidity in the ocean is affecting their sense of smell and their ability to navigate. But I think overall, the just change in acidity, the pH in the ocean is really throwing off the entire marine ecosystem.
So that bigger fish would die because they wouldn't have these animals to eat, or?
I think it's just I mean, think about the environment that you're living in. I think it's all connected. Even the fish that are eating the smaller fish and the shellfish that are relying on, you know, the kelp beds and all of that, I think it's all interconnected with just them being not able to live in an environment that is more acidic. I mean, think about if Earth and the world that we live in, the oxygen that we breathe in, is the air that we breathe in, is a different chemistry than what we're used to. Like, all life would have to adapt to this new chemistry. And I think the ocean, which we don't see as much as humans, are really experiencing this change in a way that is going a lot faster than what we're feeling on land.
And why is it happening faster in the Pacific off our coast? Because, well, climate change is happening all over the world.
Right. And I think this goes back to, so we're used to El Ninos and La Ninas and these just cycles of really extreme weather. And, you know, to make really complicated things simple, it's these climate cycles and weather patterns and wind patterns that really shift the extremes and makes the extremes more extreme on the West Coast. And with, you know, certain climate cycles in this study, they confirmed that, you know, the way some wind cycles pull warmer water on the surface offshore, which allows colder water with more nutrients and more carbon to come up closer to the surface, you know, that really amplifies the acidification effect. And then that compounded with increase in carbon emissions that the surface water is already absorbing just creates, you know, more chemical reactions that allow the ocean to get more sour.
Rosanna Shaw is environmental reporter with the LA Times. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Coming up, a public defender who wants to become LA County DA. My interview with Rachel Rossi next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The California primary is less than 3 months away, and while most of the attention is on the presidential race, here in LA, there's another big race on the ballot, and that is for LA County District Attorney. The current DA, Jackie Lacey, is facing challenges from two candidates on the left. One of them is Rachel Rossi. Unlike the other candidates, she has no prosecutorial experience, but she's a former public defender for both LA County and the federal government. Rachel Rossi joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so great to have you. For those who do not know who you are, introduce yourself.
My name is Rachel Rossi. I'm the first county and federal public defender to run for prosecutor in LA County. And that is the point. That is why I'm running, because I think LA County is ready for bold, transformative change.
So what kind of bold, transformative change would you bring?
The biggest thing that I think we need in LA County is a change from the status quo. Every day in our courts, we see that we are prosecuting the mentally ill or prosecuting our homeless neighbors, and that our jails are now 80% Black and brown. We need a prosecutor who has seen the other side of the system, who's seen the impact of the criminal justice system on families and communities, and who is willing to change that day to day and to have a vision for an LA County that is more just.
Well, what does that mean in practicality? The job is prosecutor. I mean, you're not running to be the county's public defender. You're running to be a prosecutor. So that entails prosecuting people who've committed crimes.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to focus our resources on prosecuting actual crime. So one of the things I would focus on as DA, if you look at the mental health diversion that exists in LA County, we see very, very low numbers of people suffering from mental illness getting accepted into the diversion that exists. I think the first problem with that is that the district attorney makes a recommendation to the program on who gets in and who goes to jail. So the DA has a very, very large voice in who gets treatment and who goes to jail when it comes to mental illness. I would change it so that the district attorney has to consider the advice of a mental health practitioner in making that decision.
Mm. And so the current program you're saying put forward by Jackie Lacey, the current DA, you think it is inadequate. It's not really working.
I think the program's great. I think we are not seeing enough admissions into the program. There was a Department of Mental Health study that found that almost 3,000 of the people in our jails right now who suffer from mental illness could safely be transitioned into community-based services. If that's the case, then we are not utilizing community-based services enough, and we are over-criminalizing those with mental illness in our community.
Are there enough beds to divert 3,000 people to community-based services? Are there enough places for them?
Beds and resources will always have been an issue in LA County for some time, and we have to look at where we are spending our resources. When we are spending $800 million a year to incarcerate people in LA County jails, why are our resources being overspent on incarceration, and why are we not providing enough resources toward community-based services? I think that's one of the things that the district attorney has to have a leading voice in, expanding the resources to programs that exist, and expanding the resources to the Office of Diversion and Reentry, and shifting the way that we look at criminal justice.
And why are you the better candidate than former San Francisco DA George Gascon, who's also running on a progressive platform? He also has prosecutorial experience, which you do not. Why are you the better candidate?
I'm the only candidate who's been in federal court. I'm the only candidate who's seen the other side of the criminal justice system. And I'm the only candidate who's worked in Washington, D.C. on policies, on criminal justice reform policies, federally, nationally, but also that implicate the states across the country. And so I bring a unique perspective. And I think the reason why that's important is that we've now started to see a prosecutor that functions as an adversary of the defense and who only seeks conviction and the most amount of time possible. We need a prosecutor who seeks justice. And sometimes justice means incarceration. Sometimes justice means humanity, treatment, programs, therapy, services. And as a former public defender, I've seen the courtrooms in LA. I've seen all the courtrooms in LA, both county and federal, and I would bring a different vision and a different humanity to the role of prosecutor.
And what do you say to the victims of crime or the relatives of murder victims who might be hearing you and think, well, you're talking a lot about criminals or alleged criminals, and you're not really talking about the victims of crime?
I think there's two important things here. If we stop wasting resources on over-incarceration of low-level offenders, then we have increased resources for the crimes that are serious, that are violent. Right now in our LA County jails, there's only 33% of people incarcerated who are facing serious or violent charges. That means we are wasting a lot of money on incarcerating people who should not be in jail. And second, I would say, you know, one of my main platform issues is supporting victims, listening to survivors, and providing access to restorative justice options if that is what they wish, and providing notice and providing a voice to victims in the criminal justice system. Right now, my experience being in the LA County courts was seeing victims sort of propped up as a tool to gain a conviction. I didn't see a prosecutorial policy of listening to victims, supporting victims, or providing them the resources that they need to get back on their feet, to get treatment, to get services, to get help.
Jackie Lacey has not brought charges against any police officer who has been involved in an officer-related homicide. Would you do otherwise? And do you think that there are officers that she should have prosecuted?
I believe that the first step, the problem with our current criminal justice system in LA County, is that we have an inherent conflict of interest when we have DAs who work alongside law enforcement every day, then making the decision to whether or not to prosecute law enforcement. I believe that the first step for our prosecutor needs to be getting rid of that conflict of interest and providing a separation in who's making the decision to prosecute law enforcement. The way that I would do that today is by utilizing current law to appoint independent prosecutors in cases where law enforcement use of force results in death. I believe in all those cases, there should be a separate independent office that is taking a look at that case, investigating that case, and deciding whether or not charges should be filed. In all other cases involving law enforcement accused misconduct, there is a justice integrity division in the DA's office today, but it is still within the DA's office, and it does not have any separation or ethical divide from the prosecutors who work alongside that law enforcement every day. I would increase the ethical divide between the Justice Integrity Division and the rest of the office, including by putting prosecutors in that office who have civil rights experience and who have backgrounds in prosecuting law enforcement, including a geographic separation. That office should be separate and apart from the rest of the district attorney's office. What we need is to bring faith back to our communities in LA that the justice system is not bought or sold, and that the justice system doesn't depend on your wealth, your status, or the uniform that you wear to work.
Is there any issue in your mind that your campaign manager ran the campaign of Sheriff Alex Villanueva? He has gotten into some hot water with the supervisors for a couple of things, rehiring a deputy who worked on his campaign and was fired by the county for suspected domestic violence. Also, the supervisors are upset at his spending. There's a $60 million or so deficit at the sheriff's office. Is there a problem there that you share the same campaign manager?
No, not at all. I think Paula Ramirez is a fantastic campaign manager. She ran a fantastic campaign with a candidate who fooled her just as he fooled a lot of LA County. A lot of people that voted for Alex Villanueva believed that he would bring change and believed that he would be a reformer to our justice system, and he's not. And unfortunately, oftentimes, we don't know what our elected officials will do after they are elected. And that's why my background, again, is so important, because my background and experience reflects an entire career focused on the people and focused on defending people, and it reflects what I will do in the future.
So it sounds like you do not support Sheriff Villanueva.
I have a lot of concerns about the sheriff's department, about what Sheriff Villanueva has been doing. And I think that we need a district attorney who is vocal about that and who is standing up for justice again and for a sheriff's department that has some checks and balances on it.
And what role do you see yourself playing in addressing LA's homelessness crisis? You have talked about diverting people to mental health programs. There aren't enough, obviously, for the amount of homeless people on the streets right now. So what role do you see yourself playing in trying to reduce homelessness or trying to break the cycle of them being arrested, going out, you know, being released and rearrested over and over again?
Mm-hmm. I believe that what we need in LA County is to stop prosecuting the homeless and to start focusing on providing resources and community services to our houseless neighbors. And we also need to focus on holding accountable the people who cause homelessness by evictions and raising rents in illegal or unethical ways. As district attorney, I would stop prosecuting crimes such as sleeping on the sidewalk. But I would also assemble a houselessness fraud task force to investigate big developers, large corporate landlords that are raising rents, evicting people, and starting to be the large part of the homelessness crisis in our county. Last year, there was a 13% increase in homelessness in LA County. About 11% of that 13% was people who just couldn't afford their rent. So while we do have a significant number of people on Skid Row who have mental health issues, who have substance use issues, we're now seeing a vast increase in homelessness in LA County just because people cannot afford their rent. And we need a DA who will hold people accountable and will fight homelessness and not fight the homeless.
Rachel Rossi, she's running for Los Angeles County District Attorney. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, how to become an adult. There's a class for that.
I think if you keep asking your parents, then you're never going to want to learn yourself because you know that there's always going to be somebody to help you out.
A popular class at UC Berkeley to teach college students what they really need to know. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Growing up, did someone teach you how to be an adult? You know, how to function in the world on your own by balancing a budget, saving for a house, separating whites and colors when you do the laundry. Turns out a lot of college students have not learned these basic things. And so two undergrads at UC Berkeley started what they're calling an adulting class. Belle Lau is one of them, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
So the title of your class is actually called Adulting?
Yes, that's correct.
In your mind, what does that mean, adulting?
I think it's a lot about how to be independent and self-reliant. That's like the big two for me.
Mm-hmm. And so being independent and self-reliant, presumably you learn that as you go when you're in college, right? That's sort of a natural process. You're separating from your parents and you're learning kind of on the fly how to do it. Why do people need to enroll in a class?
I don't think that they necessarily need to enroll in a class. I think that just because as college students, we are, as you mentioned, we are kind of pushed into this world. Like, you're on your own now. You have to learn how to spend your money wisely, how to balance your time between academics and like taking care of yourself and, you know, finding a job if you need to. We are kind of lost and we rely on things like Google or even our parents to help us out when we need it. But I think that it's more important to turn to ourselves instead. And so we offered this course as like an answer, I guess, to people's call for help.
So what specifically are you teaching them?
So the first week, we start off with goal setting. And so we teach them about this thing called SMART goals. So it's specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound, and how it makes all of our goals seem less daunting and seem more easily achievable. And then we kind of move on to time management and money management and fitness and nutrition, things to do with jobs like interviews and resume building, taxes, and then a couple weeks on mental health.
So that all sounds pretty reasonable. Like, I can imagine adults wanting to take your class.
Yeah, I have heard of other adults who are like, oh, I wish I could take your class if it was offered for me too.
Right. So what do you find just in going about your daily life? What do you find is the biggest need amongst your peers? Things that they don't get that you think they should have gotten by now or they need help with?
All money matters. Anything to do with money is definitely very hard because especially when you, for college students, when we're constantly studying, like I'll just go out and buy food. I'll just go out and buy coffee, things like that, where it just adds up very quickly. So learning how to be like, oh, you got to portion out your money. Like, where is it going?
You mean like create a budget, figure out where your money is being spent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, I think that's something that people even my age have trouble with. Money matters. What about interpersonal relationships? Do you find that because so many people are used to being online that they have more difficulty making social connections?
We actually did, I forgot to mention this, but we did add a topic this semester on relationships, whether that's like relationships with yourself, with family, friends, or with a significant other. And I think that that one was very helpful for people, just knowing things like boundaries and consent and compromise. And like you mentioned, with social media and all that influence, people forget how they're supposed to be interacting with peers or just other people in general.
Mm-hmm. So are you yourself administering all this advice or do you bring in experts?
Oh, no. So we're called facilitators, which is a very good term for that's pretty much exactly what we do. We facilitate the class. We engage them in discussions concerning these topics. And then we go out and look for guest speakers who we feel are experts in each of the topics. And they come in and talk for about like 45 minutes to an hour about that specific topic.
And what's the popularity of your class? How many people in it?
So we've held the class for two semesters. And the first semester, we had 30 seats max that we could hold and 100 applications. So we were like, wow, that was, we didn't expect that much popularity. So for this semester, we increased it to two sections of 30 students each and then had 200 applications to look through.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you choose? Is it first come, first serve, or do you pick the most helpless cases?
We kind of look for people who are struggling the most, but also people who are very enthusiastic to learn.
Struggling the most. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds really bad. I don't mean, maybe people who are, yeah, helpless, I guess is a better word.
Just, you need a little something extra, need a helping hand. But I guess my bigger question is, so what's wrong with asking your parents or Google for advice? I mean, I do that sometimes.
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to rely on other resources, but I think that it's important to be self-reliant and it's important to know how to do these basic things, because I think if you keep asking your parents, then you're never going to want to learn yourself, because you know that there's always going to be somebody to help you out.
Okay. Sounds like a little dose of tough love there, Belle.
Yeah.
Belle Lau, student instructor at UC Berkeley. She has launched a class there called Adulting. Coming up, how the Hallmark Channel profits off nostalgia and how that's getting them into trouble this Christmas season. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, which means one thing, time to talk TV.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get those.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you, treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
She said.
Well, today let's talk about the Hallmark Channel. It's that time of year when Hallmark airs its Christmas movies multiple times a day until the year ends. Hallmark has 40 new Christmas movies this year. And here's a trailer for one of them. It's called Right Before Christmas, as in W-R-I-T-E, as in write a Christmas card.
I'm taking a holiday from dating. And while I'm at it, I'm taking a holiday from holidays.
A simple act of kindness.
Who doesn't love opening a Christmas card?
Can change your life forever.
Oh, sorry.
That card brought me here.
Wow.
Chad Michael Murray and Tori DeVito star in a romantic holiday movie.
Shouldn't we be on a sleigh somewhere?
No, I'm happy right here.
Right Before Christmas.
Well, the channel, known for love stories and happy endings, is also known for something else, mostly telling stories of straight white couples. Last week, Hallmark pulled an ad showing two brides getting married. A spokesman for the channel said the kiss the couple shared violated their policies. And yet, a few days and lots of backlash later, they're now reinstating that ad. Here to tell us more about how Hallmark struggles to diversify is Sarah Larson. She wrote about Hallmark for The New Yorker. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you. Also joining us is Matt Pivovarczyk. He co-hosts the podcast All Things Cozy. It's about all things cozy, and he's a Hallmark fan. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so Matt, you're a member of the LGBTQ community. What did you think of this whole controversy over that ad?
It was definitely disappointing to see Hallmark just give in to bigotry right away. I would have liked to have seen them, you know, stick up for inclusiveness, but it is encouraging that they've retracted their decision and have reinstated the ad. But, you know, this is also a great opportunity for them to listen to this backlash and actually include more voices in their programming.
Yeah. So how do you feel in general watching the movies where it's mainly featuring, or it's only featuring, straight people's romances?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you've ever watched a Hallmark movie, you know that most of the plots are virtually identical, and that extends to the people who star in it. But what makes Hallmark movies so enjoyable to watch as a viewer, really, especially around Christmas time, is that there's such a clear sense of time and place, and you're immediately transported to Christmas and all those nostalgic feelings. And so, you know, especially when a channel is producing, you know, 40 of these original movies across Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, there's so much opportunity for including different representations of family. And so I would like to see, you know, more representations of different types of families in Hallmark movies.
Sarah, what is the creative philosophy behind these movies? What is their goal, Hallmark's goal?
Hallmark is basically taking familiar, beloved actors who we've seen in other things and grown up watching on TV, beautiful settings, including old-fashioned towns and houses that might look familiar either from our own childhoods or from TV, And, you know, other cozy, familiar, comforting things, holidays, etc. And then they have a very reliable structure, a nine-act structure in which certain things happen. So, you know, even though the plots differ and the details differ, you're very instinctively getting something cozy and reassuring in every single movie, down to the way things unfold, yeah. And down to the hot cocoa with marshmallows and the tree lightings and the.
So it's like a Thomas Kinkade painting brought to life.
There, I was so upset. I had a quote in my piece that got cut out, but a character in an early movie says to another character, "Is that an original Thomas Kinkade?" And Andrew McCarthy is like, yes.
Andrew McCarthy? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a crabby, grizzled rancher, and he owns original Thomas Kinkade art.
Oh, boy.
As they all do.
There's a lot of people like that stuff, but a lot of people find it really too much. Just saccharine.
I mean, they are formulaic, but it is reassuring and cozy to turn on something and know exactly what you're going to get.
So how does it differ from watching It's a Wonderful Life every year? It's kind of similar in the nostalgia field, right?
I mean, definitely. I mean, you are kind of hitting at certain, life, you know, family themes of togetherness and love. But that actually, I mean, that almost is kind of what's so disappointing about the situation, which is, you know, in these movies, the heroes learn a lesson about how they're going to, you know, eschew big business and they're going to live in a small town and return to family values. And it's kind of interesting how, like, in this controversy, Hallmark should probably listen to the messages of its own movies and think about how like, the actual meaning of Christmas and what that means.
Sarah, it is Christmas. I mean, it's not Hanukkah. It's not Kwanzaa. It's Christmas.
It's a little Hanukkah this year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, two movies this year.
There are two new movies that are Hanukkah movies.
They're Christmas movies with a dash of Hanukkah.
Oh, okay. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Okay, yeah. We have a clip from one of them. It's called Holiday Date.
Joel.
Brooke.
He's an actor.
He could be the boyfriend you're bringing home for the holidays.
It's all an act.
We might actually get away with this.
Until it isn't.
You have a really pretty smile.
Brittany Bristow and Matt Cohen star.
Everything about Whispering Pines is magical.
Talk about a Christmas to remember.
Holiday Date.
Okay, Sarah, what is this about?
Well, it's kind of a classic Hallmark holiday plot, which is the fake boyfriend or the fake date to appease nosy relatives or coworkers. That's used a lot. And then it's always, you know, they actually fall in love. It wasn't the smartest plot, in my opinion, to combine with someone who reveals himself to be Jewish because, you know, there was an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that this was anti-Semitic and that, you know, there's a stereotype of a sneaky Jew, which, you know, that didn't cross my mind. But I think it made this plot overly complicated and a little bit nuts. However, there's some really lovely Hanukkah stuff in this movie. I actually went to the set of that movie and I watched some scenes being shot and all I could see was Christmas and I was sort of cringing. But actually, there's, you know, there's some singing in Hebrew. There's some nice, they light a menorah and there's some very sweet scenes. I wish they could have just, you know, just had only Hanukkah, but baby steps. I mean, I think the unspoken thing here is that Hallmark has a lot of very right-wing viewers because it's so general and family-friendly and sort of rated G. There's no swearing. There's no sex. There's, you know, one to two kisses per movie. I think Hallmark has tried to avoid alienating anyone, including the most conservative viewers they have, without angering anyone else. And this weekend, you know, when they pulled that ad, that was the first time that it really erupted. They've been criticized rightly for their lack of diversity for a long time, and they've made improvements there with representation. But yeah, I had an awkward conversation with the CEO about gay representation in Hallmark movies when I asked him, there was a gay couple, I thought, in a movie last year, Road to Christmas, which I loved. And I said, I thought I saw a gay couple in one of your movies. And he immediately knew which movie I was talking about. And he said, you did. And then I said, well, you can't tell that they're gay. And he said, that's what's so great about it. You know, we're not calling them out.
Oh,
we're
wow.
just in, we're including them and letting them live their lives, but we're not, you know, trying to draw attention to them.
And he saw that as good?
Yeah. I think he genuinely thought that that was kind of gracious, but I also think it was a cop-out.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt, what goes through your mind when you hear that, when you hear what the CEO said?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely rings true. When I'm often scanning the background actors to see which gay couples they sort of stood next to each other as kind of like a nod to acknowledging that LGBT people watch Hallmark movies too. And you can kind of spot them occasionally. Mm-hmm. I've read some interviews with filmmakers that say that they intentionally put those couples in the background. But it's very subtle. And, you know, I think Hallmark thinks it's being apolitical by not including same-sex couples as the protagonists in its stories. But that omission is itself political. And again, like, when you're producing so much content, so many original Christmas movies, you know, why not and? Why not plus something where there's something for every family? Every family can see themselves represented on screen.
I mean, it's really interesting in this moment that Hallmark, trying to be apolitical, trying to appeal to everybody, is making a political statement, because we now view that as being political, as taking a side, rather than perhaps in the past we might have viewed
yes.
this as being neutral. But that doesn't exist anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a glaring omission when you have services like Netflix putting out original Christmas movies that do feature LGBT couples prominently. And so, you know, there are other alternatives available now that are competing for the same audience that Hallmark is serving with its very unique style of movie. And, you know, for a channel that really did establish that, you know, I would think as a viewer, they would want to stay ahead of that, but they seem to be falling behind.
But you'll still watch.
I mean, yeah. I mean, at this point, I've watched, I don't know, hundreds of straight couples fall in love and find the true meaning of Christmas. I don't necessarily plan on stopping now, but, you know, I might just stop because there are so many more alternatives than there used to be.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, like, yeah. And especially if there are, like, decisions where it's clear that Hallmark is giving into bigots who are bullying them and they decide to take that standing. Obviously, they've reversed course in this direction, but, you know, that may not be a channel for me.
Sarah Larson is a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can read her story on Hallmark in the current issue. Matt Pivovarczyk is co-host of the podcast All Things Cozy. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. So blue, just thinking about you.
That is one of my favorite Christmas songs.
Fun fact, I love almost all Christmas songs. Despite my general salty demeanor, I love Christmas music so much.
And you love yourself some Elvis, yes?
Of course, I love myself some Elvis, some
on.
Bing. All of the greatest
the strange hits. First names. Okay.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Adulting.
Yes.
It's hard. I asked listeners what they had the biggest struggles with when they were moving out of their parents' house into mm-hmm. the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce says being prepared for unexpected expenses, learning to track spending and create a budget and then stick to it. That remains a problem for a lot of people well out of
As I
college?
Kept saying to the young woman I interviewed, all of the things she was saying.
You never stop learning how to
you
adult.
You never stop learning. It's always a struggle.
It's always a struggle. It continues. It's the human condition.
Well, it's better than the alternative.
It's true.
Michelle Alloy, thank you. Happy Blue Christmas.
Won't be one without you.
I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.